Well, I have many hats to wear today. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Mary Mullen, a member of the program committee. We welcome all of you, no matter what your family structure, what your sexual orientation, what your religious background is, what your abilities or your inabilities are. We welcome you here today. We have a different program today. Sometimes our minister, Sandy Ingham, is our speaker, but she's not today. Sometimes we have someone from outside our congregation. That's also not true today. Today we have someone from our congregation, Faith Colvin, who will be leading us later on, and I'll introduce her later. Opening word.
The opening words, if you have come here merely to help us, you are wasting our time. But if you come because your liberation is bound to help, is bound up with ours, then let us work together. That's Angela Davis.
The chalice lighting will be read by two young people. I think they know who they are.
There are seats over here.
When the Spirit struck us free, we could scarcely believe it for very joy.
Were we free? Were we wrapped in a dream of freedom?
Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with pure joy.
The oppressors were awestruck.
What marvels the Lord works for them.
Like a torrent in flood, our people streamed out.
Locks, bars, gulags, ghettos, cages, cuffs, a nightmare scattered.
We trod the long furrow of slaves, sowing in tears.
A lightning bolt loosed us.
We tread the long furrow, half drunk with joy staggering.
The golden sheaves in our arms.
I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, and she's not only a speaker because many of you will probably be speaking as well, but Faith Chauvin is our speaker. She's been attending Prairie for about a year and a half, and I've come to know her as a woman of passion, an excellent writer, and also an eloquent speaker, and she's brought both her daughter and her granddaughter to Prairie. In the months I've known Faith, she's joined Prairie's program committee. She's also joined the Dunn's Marsh Neighborhood Association as a council member. And she also attends the Meadowood Memoir Writers Group along with Rick Recking and me, so she's getting quite integrated into the community here. Maybe a more important thing to know about her is that for most of her life she's been a community organizer and also an urban planner. And in the past, she's also formed an interracial women's support group. Maybe she's formed several of these. I just know, I'm for sure it's one. And she hopes to form one of them in our neighborhood as well, which is the neighborhood where Prairie is. She's going to be leading us in what she calls a dialogue rather than a presentation or a reflection. And dialogue means, of course, that we'll be invited to share our thoughts that pertain to the subject in hand. And the title of the service is Our Second Principle and Overcoming Racism. Faith, she's right there.
Yes, for our purposes this morning, I thought a dialogue would be the best way to approach this topic of confronting racism with the backdrop of our second principle in promoting justice, equality, and compassion. Because I think that bringing to light our own experiences in with the Black community would be the best way of bringing it home in understanding. For me, I think two aspects of this topic are most relevant. I think, first of all, we have to confront our own inner psychological barriers to changing things, to changing white supremacy and racism, our resistance to change, our inner psychological problems with that, and also our own fear and guilt and resentment, which we may feel, which leads to our lack of understanding and a lack of engagement with the Black community, a lack of knowledge because of the physical separation which exists. I mean, In Madison, all you have to do is look around to see we're still very segregated. I guess I'd like to begin by asking you just to imagine for your own self what it would be like with a community without racial and class prejudice, what that would look like for you. I mean, by that I mean, if you gave up your own racial and class privilege with the advantages that entails, with that property ownership could maybe, or vehicle ownership, extensive travel around the world that so many of you've had, financial security, excellent health care, good food all the time, nice clothing, time to pursue and money to pursue hobbies and interests, great educations that most of us have had for ourselves and for our children. If we had no our racial prejudice in this world, would we be able to keep those good things all? Or would there be some sacrifice involved? Or would everybody get some of those things, or all of those things? And if there were no white supremacy, how many of those things would you be willing to give up in the name of equality? Because if we're talking about overcoming racism, you have to confront what the consequences of that would actually be. Otherwise, it's just an empty thought or phrase that we're mouthing. So you have to think about, what would that world look like, and what would I be willing to do or to give? So I guess when I think about that, and maybe it would be a world where everybody gets some of that. I don't know. I don't have the answers to that. But I think it's something we'd have to think about. So while you think about that, I'll tell you a little bit about myself and why I think I have the passion I do, and maybe some of the background to talk about this a little bit. I was born in Beloit, and my father was a labor organizer. He was born in 1899, actually. So he organized in the 20s and 30s when it was a really dangerous thing to do. And he was a very, very committed person himself. And because his office was in the basement of our home, I grew up meeting people in the labor union and seeing how it worked, kind of, and being inspired by some of the work he did and being imbued with his sense of commitment and passion. But unfortunately, he died when I was 10 years old, so I was kind of left a little rudderless. And so I remember my first images I can remember seeing on the television set, or some of the first images, were of the civil rights movement and of people being sprayed by fire hoses. And I know you all remember, and we're a part of some of that. I know I'm talking to a lot of movement people here. And part of the reason that I feel brave enough to talk about this with you is because I know I have an audience of people whose hearts are all in really the right place. I feel that from you. I feel that you have a lot of love in your heart. And so I know you remember what it was like back in the late 50s and early 60s for black people. And I know that many of you were committed and had a part in marches and helping to change laws and teachings and all different kinds of things. But anyway, for me it meant I went to Oakland. I thought I was 15. I left home. I ran away from home to join the Black Panthers. And although that didn't work out well for me, actually, it meant 7 years of kind of hard times for me. I was on the street for for a time, and I had to overcome some dark heroin addiction and some stuff. But anyway, I got back to school, and I went to Beloit College. I graduated from there, and then I went to the UW. And I became an urban planner, and I wrote a grant for a program down and went back to Beloit because I knew that there were a lot of people, some women that I had known earlier in my life that really didn't get out of the neighborhood. There was a neighborhood in Beloit, the Merrill neighborhood it was called, that really didn't get out of there much, and I really wanted to help. And I was going to volunteer for the visitor program, but they said, why don't you try for a grant? And I didn't, and I got it. I don't think they read the grant, the funder, because it was written from a Marxist perspective. And I'm sure if they understood what I was wanted to do. But I came in there on my white horse, you know. I thought I was going to save these people, you know. I thought I was going to save people. And, you know, I was really devastated, shocked and disappointed to find out that they didn't want saving, at least not by me. It worked out in the end. After a few years, we came to know and trust each other. But at first, I was totally rejected. I mean, they were like, you know, what are you doing here, and why do you want to help us? And are you going to write a book about us? Do you have some ulterior motive? What is it? You know, could you possibly? And they had no, they were totally mistrustful. They said, and if you're here for the right reasons, anyway, a black woman should have this job. And and then the white people who I was trying to get help from to get jobs for the women were saying things like, you shouldn't be here. What are you doing here helping these people? And it was just a learning situation for me, let's put it that way. And I learned a lot of humility because I thought I was Che Guevara, and I turned out to be I don't know who, some bumbling fool, actually. But I did it for about 10 years, and I know I learned a lot more than I gave. It was an incredible experience for me. But I never went into another situation thinking that I was going to save or help anybody. I mean, I believed from then on that my liberation had to be, I needed to want liberation as much as I wanted it for other people. It had to be for me as much as for anyone else, or it was never going to work. So from then on, I did other women's groups. I did one at Somerset Circle in the 80s, in the bad old days when crack came out, and that was called Women of Wisdom, and that that was for, excuse me, women with really bad substance abuse issues. And since I had a substance issue too, that worked really well. And then I did another. I don't know if any of you have heard of Project Respect, but that's for women who've been in the life in prostitution in Madison. And I was involved in that for about 20 years, helping to organize with that. So that's kind of, I don't want to, right now I'm working with Yahara House, both as a member and as a volunteer. And you'll hear more about that next week, because some people from Yahara House are coming next week. And one of the things I'm trying to do there is, there's really not a lot of diversity there. And we're trying to get more involvement with people from the jail and from the neighborhoods, because it's, as with most mental health organizations in Dane County, they're mostly focused on white people. But anyway, that's me. But what I tell you that about myself, because, and more than I would share normally, but it's because I want you to know why this is so important to me. And I want you to feel comfortable sharing your stories, because I want to hear them. And I want us to share with each other our stories about working in the community and being with people. And I want us to talk about where we were then, where we are now, and what we can do to advance the cause of overcoming racism in our community. What we can do now, what we think we can do now. And we can take it anywhere you want to. And then just so you leave me a few minutes at the end so I can, I've got some pointers, I think. All right, well, I'll finish up. I'm sorry this is running late, but I'm kind of glad. I'm really glad that people were so engaged. And but I'd like to finish up by saying I got a few ideas about how we can concretely take some steps. Some are big things, but some are little. I think that if we're serious about wanting to change ourselves and our communities, we can start thinking about these things. Buying property or our homes in integrated neighborhoods. Frequenting black-owned businesses. Promoting integration wherever we are, in our businesses, in our clubs, in our whatever we belong to. I think taking courses in black history is essential. I think, and if you audit a course at the university, if you're over 62, it's free. If you belong to a neighborhood association, that's a good thing, especially, and promote integration there. If you work for a political campaign for a black candidate, that's a really good thing. If you go to art galleries, or if you go to if you socialize with people of color on a social level, not where you're ministering to people or giving to people, when you're operating on a level of friendship, one-to-one, as equals. Go to clubs, go to art galleries, go to plays, meet as friends in a coffee shop and promote that. There's a website that's called blackcityinfo.com that you can check out. And there is a book club called the Social Justice Book Club that meets the second and fourth Fridays of the month. Right now they're discussing Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the Worlds. One thing that I am really excited about, I want to tell you about, is called, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Nehemiah Organization, but there's a group called Justified Anger, and it's run by Dr. Alex G. He's a pastor of a Fountain of Life Church. And he's got a series of classes going on. It's closed up, but it's every Tuesday night from 7 to 9. And it's a class in how to be a white ally to the black community. And the important thing about it is that, well, it's 150 white people who are being taught by, guided by, I should say, by some really savvy black people. And it's wonderful. I mean, the class started with history, and then we get into small groups and discuss. It's just great, and I'm sure they're going to have it again. So I'll keep you posted about that. And he even said last week that they're going to have some panel discussions as an adjunct to that, where outside people could come. And then I want to finish by saying that if you do attend groups or you're in situations or you're working together with black people, like in social action groups and stuff, I got some tips that I think, you know, you may know these, but I'm just going to reiterate them. Just pause before contributing to the conversation. Just listen, you know, be ready to listen, because it's always better to listen than to come off as patronizing. Black people have been told enough what to do by us. They want to be, like I know in our neighborhood, we have two neighborhood councils because there's such animosity. They don't want to be even involved with the white side of the neighborhood because they're so suspicious of our motives. We've got to build bridges, and we've got to be willing to listen a lot more. When you're with other white people who make comments that are dubious, check them immediately. When you're in a situation like, excuse yourself from having strong emotions. Like, don't be, like, say you're in a situation where racism is being described in a powerful way. Don't over-emote, because they feel like, well, at least that's what was described in what I've been reading. They don't want to have to take care of you or have the focus put on you again. It's like, it's about them this time, you know? And finally, have a support group of white people with whom you can vent some of this stuff so that you can be taking some of the stuff that may not be appropriate in right now. And just keep trying, you know. Your overtures initially may be spurned. They may not be wanted at certain times and certain points. So what? It may be difficult or uncomfortable to overcome and confront racism, but it's not as hard as it is to live it. So keep trying, and we'll encourage and support each other in it. It's worth it. It really is.
So, greet your neighbor and stay for Soup Sunday.